You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. We are talking today about Searchlight New Mexico, and we're going to find out what that is in a moment. I'm delighted to welcome Susan Bowe, who is Executive Director of Searchlight New Mexico, Sarah Solovich, who is Executive Editor, and reporter Amy Lynn. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So what is Searchlight? How did it get started? What's going on?
Searchlight was formed about a year and a half ago by Ray Rivera, who was then editor of the Santa Fe New Mexican. And he saw a need in New Mexico for a nonprofit investigative journalism organization that would work with other media in the state of New Mexico to produce stories and to look at issues on sort of a long-form basis of journalism. The reality is, in today's newsrooms, that generally there's not enough money or resources to devote to investigative journalism, and that is basically all we are doing. We're not doing daily journalism, and so we're not competing with other daily or weekly newspapers in the state, but instead we're trying to form partnerships with them, and we will produce and post all of our stories on our website, but we're also providing them free of charge to the other newspapers in the state who are interested in partnering with us. And right now, we probably have agreements with maybe 90% of the newspapers in New Mexico.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah, we're very fortunate, and our first stories that were published on January 21st were covered in the front page of most of the Sunday editions of the major newspapers in New Mexico. And so the beauty of that is that all New Mexicans, or those who read newspapers at least, are receiving the same information generally at the same time, so we can have a dialogue or conversation using the same stories and the same set of facts.
How do you imagine that those conversations will take place among the many people who might be reading in different parts of the state?
Well, of course, there's the internet and especially social media, where a lot of that discussion occurs. But as we develop, we hope to hold events or town forums in different parts of the state where we can get input from citizens and we can start talking about these issues.
Now, the first year, as I understand it, is all the reporting is devoted to a theme. Is that correct?
That's right. The theme is child well-being in New Mexico, and it's going to be the lens through which we look at the state's issues and problems, and also look at solutions and what might be working. As you know, and I think most New Mexicans are aware of the fact that on most scales that look at child well-being, we rank either 49th or 50th.
Which is something that has been going on for so long that the phrase, thank God for Mississippi, is something that many people recognize, like if we're 49th, they're 50th in many rankings. And I think because we've been talking about the problems for so long, there's a kind of like, I don't know, almost apathy, like, yeah, we're pretty bad. What are we going to do about it? You're proposing, or the goal of this series is to propose solutions.
We want to look at solutions that have worked in other states, and we are not a social advocacy group. We're still a journalism organization, and so it's not necessarily our responsibility to come up with those solutions, but at least we can provide the facts and the groundwork for starting these discussions.
One of the interesting things that has been written about, that's being written about by you, Sarah Solovich, is the link between early childhood education and economic development. Tell us about that.
Well, that's right. So we wanted to look at what happens if you do nothing. What are the economic costs of doing nothing? Because of course we know that to lift ourselves out of the problems that have been created over the last, been ongoing for many years, it's going to cost a great deal, and it'll be a huge investment. But we wanted to look at what the real cost of doing nothing is, because that also holds a lot of problems on its own. And so among those is the problem of people leaving the state, young families, you know, that kind of demographic sweet spot of people in their 30s and 40s with young children who are looking for opportunities elsewhere, who are looking for better education for their children. The challenge of attracting companies into the state for good jobs. You know, we just learned that Amazon has chosen 20 finalist cities. And one of the, you know, two of our cities were applicants for that enormous new, you know, second headquarters that Amazon is proposing. And when I began talking to economists back in October or November for this story, they anticipated just straight out that there was no way that we were going to be considered because Amazon needs really, you know, an educated workforce and we couldn't provide it, like, you know, 50,000 people. So that's a, you know, serious problem, but it's not just the big companies that we're trying to attract. It's even small firms, small businesses that are having a very hard time keeping, attracting good workers who are dependable. There are the problems of employees who don't have secure childcare, high quality childcare for their children. And so they are often, you know, late for work. They're not as dependable. There's just not an ability to really invest themselves in any kind of work because they can't depend on a good childcare arrangement. And as it turns out, there's also the problem of, you know, when companies come in, they increasingly look at early childhood education. For years, people thought that, oh, it was just the high school education that, you know, new employers were interested in. But there are now numerous studies, national studies, that find that these same employers are now looking at younger and younger ages because they recognize that they might be coming in, they may only want some employees maybe in 5 years, but 20 years down the line, they're really going to be drawing from the ranks of those preschoolers. And increasingly, what I found, it was so interesting, is more and more of the businessmen who I spoke with, when we began the conversation, would immediately start by saying, well, do you know James Heckman? Now, James Heckman is this Nobel Prize winning economist from the University of Chicago who has done all these cost-benefit ratio studies looking at child well-being, early childhood education, and the effect that it has on the long-term economic well-being of a nation. And there is this just a very strong link. It's a kind of a, you know, it's more than a one-on-one. It's almost, he found a 13% investment benefit. So if you put, that's much more than you get from Wall Street, if you invest on Wall Street. So if you invest in your children, you're going to have a much higher return.
So spell that out for us a little bit more. If you invest, let's say, a dollar in pre-kindergarten or early childhood education, how does that reap a benefit of more than that $1 that you put in later down the line?
New Mexico's studies have found that the benefit is actually $4.50 for every dollar that's invested in early childhood education. And it's not as much. It's not nearly as much as what's been found nationally by Heckman and other people. But those studies have been looking at all-day, high-quality childcare, where we don't really have the all day. We might have, say, half day, and a lot of our kids don't have any preschool or early childhood education. But the benefit is just so broad-based. It's in social skills and emotional development and learning, you know, what they keep referring to as the soft skills. I talked to this one business leader who said that, you know, everywhere he goes around the state, business people are saying, our employees don't show up on time. You know, they don't understand how to communicate with customers who are coming in. And his point was that you can't send in professors or business leaders to talk to kids when they're in grade 10 or 11 and 12 and start addressing those kinds of values and soft skills. You've got to get them when they're really young.
And so that translates into the economic piece, 20 years later, let's say, or 30 years later, when those people are bringing home better salaries?
Better salaries, better education. Of course, they're paying taxes. They're not depending on the same kinds of social services. Kids who get early education have been found to be much less in need of being retained, you know, but in held back a year and having to repeat grade one in kindergarten. New Mexico has one of the highest rates of retention, grade retention, of any state in the country. So that's an enormous. That costs the state something like, I think it's $5,000 per child to hold them back an extra year. Special education, which as we all know is incredibly costly and so detrimental to the self-respect of, you know, sense of self-esteem that a child carries into the world. And so these are just things that, you know, you might not be able to put a dollar on per child, but it starts to kind of imbue the whole culture and the well-being of the family and the community and the state. It just permeates through the wider culture and has an effect.
It's interesting to hear you saying that businesses, when they are considering New Mexico, are thinking 20, 30, whatever years down the line, because there's a kind of truism that people repeat about businesses is that they're only concerned with their quarterly profits or what's happening mm-hmm. now, short-term thinking. You're encountering people who are doing long-term thinking, perhaps longer-term thinking than our own elected officials.
I think so. And it's coming from the national level. You know, the Chamber of Commerce nationally is talking about it. Business leaders are talking about it nationally, and they're starting to come back to the states and, you know, I think address people. And then, you know, when I talked to national experts, they were very familiar with some of the problems in New Mexico, and they pointed to people locally. Like, for instance, Jason Espinoza, of the Association of Commerce and Industry. And people had in Washington had mentioned him and told me that he really got it, that they've heard him speak and that he's aware of these same, you know, these very problems. So it's something that is bubbling up, I think, from the local level, but it's also coming down, you know, like top down. And everybody's starting to read what's happening, what all these different studies are. They're coming from the economists around the state, but also nationally and around the world. And there's just this widespread understanding that child well-being is really not something that you do to be moral and, you know, to take the high ground, but it's something that one does in self-interest and preservation.
You know, it's interesting to me to talk about motivations. I talked once to a music teacher who was being interviewed and said, well, you know, music is good for the brain and makes you better at math and all these things. And he was like, and music is good because it's music. And I think there's something to be said for also regarding education as a value in itself. I mean, critical thinking, knowledge, all of these things, whether, and it does have an economic benefit, but it's also a benefit in itself, isn't it?
Well, of course, but I think that we somehow implicitly understand that, but there's also a sense that we have to, you know, we're almost on the defensive in that sense, you know, in that regard, that we feel that we have to argue for it and give it some kind of economic rationale because there's such a shortage of resources and funds. So we can't just simply say it's for our good, it's for the children or our future, which of course we all know, and our children should be educated. But instead we're being, you know, somehow we feel impelled to argue on this very, you know, like simplistic cost-benefit ratio, which isn't really the way that I think any of us, you know, are driven to do.
Yeah, I mean, is there anyone who doesn't remember being in school and hearing somebody say, what are you going to do with an English degree? You know, and it turns out that there's a lot of things you can do with an English or an art degree because you've learned skills, which is exactly, I think, what you're talking about. Now, how does this, what appears to be, as you're talking about, kind of groundswell of understanding of how important early childhood education is, how does that make it into a kind of political understanding? Here are things that we need to do First of all, identifying what those things actually are here in New Mexico and then paying for them.
I think we just always have to recognize that if our children can't read and if they can't do simple and even fairly, it's, you know, complicated math, then they're going to have very few opportunities as they get older. It's not simply, you know, for economic reasons, but that's a pretty important reason to, as we move into the 21st century. Our kids and our families are going to be held back, and they will have no future. There will be nothing for them because it's just that simple. We're not an agrarian society anymore.
There is so much conversation about the roots of, for example, poverty, poor education, alcohol, drug abuse, and then teen suicide. And Amy Lynn, this is one thing that you've been looking at, is the way that the various deep problems that we have in New Mexico affect people, partly through the mechanism of how trauma, how negative experiences affect the brain, affect really long-term development.
What really interested me about this story is the connection between what we experience and what happens in our body. I mean, I think we all know that if you have a terrible childhood and you're traumatized, it's going to make life difficult. But the fact that the trauma actually creates a stimulation of your stress hormones, and that that acts on your brain, and even very small infants, in fact, particularly small infants, have this stress response that gets ingrained, and their brain gets overwhelmed with stress hormones, and it changes all kinds of things in the way that they're able to cope later in life. And that's, it, you can repair it, but I don't think people recognized that extent of damage until just maybe in the last 10 years.
One of the things you've looked at is a 10-question survey about negative experiences, traumatic experiences, and if people get something like 2 or 3 or more of them, their chances of success are lower. And some of them include, I'm going to read some of these questions, like, did a parent or other adult in the household swear at you, insult you, put you down, things like that? Did they push, grab, or slap? Have people have had marks left on their faces, and so on? Sexual abuse, feeling unloved and neglected, divorce and separation, and so on. What happens when a young person has experienced a lot of those things on that list?
Boy, there's so many things that happen. It's almost hard to begin, but for a very young infant, the problem is that the infant has no support whatsoever. All they can do is hope that their mother takes care of them. So from the minute that they're born, they need to have somebody being loving, nurturing, and caring. If that isn't there, if there's abuse, if there's yelling, if there's hitting, if there's sexual abuse, mental illness, drug abuse, alcoholism, any number of things going on in the family, it can really interfere with a child's ability to attach to a mother, which is critical, and to feel safe and secure. And children who don't feel safe and don't feel like their needs are going to get met are going to continually have a difficult time trusting people, getting attached to people, and it also impacts learning. Early childhood trauma, they found, impacts your cognitive abilities. And so a kid who shows up in first grade and is fidgety and looks like they have ADD or this or that, it could be trauma, and they don't need to have a stimulant medication. They need to have care for trauma. So it just, there's just so many ways that it sets up children for failure.
Including shorter lives, including illnesses when they get older.
It's scary, isn't it? And I want to make sure everybody knows that this is not a recipe and it's not a prescription for disaster. You can have a lot of ACEs if you take these tests. You can have 4, 5, 6.
ACEs?
I'm sorry, that's adverse childhood experiences, and ACEs is the short phrase for it. But if you take one of these surveys, and I don't want anyone to get really upset and think they're going to die at an early age because of this, basically what happens is if you are in a position where you have a lot of these adverse experiences, you're likely to have more addiction issues, more alcoholism issues, more unemployment, even more domestic violence. And that leads in itself to a shortened lifespan. Let's say you have a lot of adversity, and so you smoke because that feels good and you're trying to self-medicate, and that can lead to lung cancer. But you can also balance out ACEs, all of us can, with our resilience and with the positive things that happen in our lives. And I'm sure everybody has some positive things that gives us the strength to overcome the adversity.
It's just that much harder, and there are wonderful stories of people who have overcome things that you just can't even believe that they got out of. And you also have, as we have in New Mexico, one generation after another, that are teaching their children to communicate, for example, through violence. Then this kid goes into school, and as in one of these articles, you know, knocks another kid off the swing because they've had never learned that you ask somebody for their turn on the swing. You just knock them off and get on the swing. So the role of the teacher then has to be not only teacher, but maybe trauma specialist too.
It's a lot to put on teachers, isn't it? The good news is that any adult who extends some care and security to a child can really make a difference. A kid needs to see somebody who they can trust and love, and someone who smiles when they walk into a room. That can be a neighbor, that can be a coach, it can be a teacher, it can be anyone in a kid's life who has a real connection that's ongoing, not just, you know, you see the kid once or twice or something like that. But children really can be helped by all of us, and that's what I found really heartwarming. I mean, I don't want to make this sound Pollyanna. This is a horrible problem, and it's a very difficult cycle to dig out of. But I think there are opportunities for everyone in a community to really focus on helping children and recognizing that the child who's acting out and might be disruptive really might need care and understanding and not punishment. I think that's a really important shift.
And that is a really deep shift that has implications for not only early childhood, but the criminal justice system and the juvenile detention system and all kinds of things.
It does. We just have to stop looking at kids as if there's something wrong with them. We have to ask what happened to them instead and really deal with the trauma by understanding that their ability to attach and have healthy relationships has been damaged, horribly damaged. They don't have trust. They don't have skills. They don't have coping mechanisms. And children can learn, especially young children, from birth to age 5. Kids can fix their brains. I mean, their brains can fix themselves. And kids can get better. They really can learn. In fact, all of us can, but it's easiest when we're younger.
Of course, prevention is easier than treatment. That would involve a kind of like family systems path toward prevention. Is that something that you're looking at also?
Exactly. And it's difficult because those interventions are more expensive. And again, it's like what Sarah said, what the state has to do and what all of us have to do, I imagine, is really understand that you can have very intensive interventions for kids. And it does have to involve the whole family to break the cycle. But it is worth the money. I mean, the payoff is that that family will be employed, will be educated, the kid will have a much better chance of an education, and that you will avoid special education costs, healthcare costs, child abuse costs, criminal justice costs, and then the extraordinary cost of having someone enter the criminal justice system and stay there.
And not only the cost to society on a dollar amount level, but the loss of these lovely or potentially lovely human beings to this society.
Exactly. And almost everyone I spoke to said we cannot think that there are throwaways. We have to just stop thinking that we can forget about kids and turn a blind eye. And really, the problem with a lot of the children who are, well, I shouldn't say that. I was going to say a lot of the children who are suffering are hidden in a way, but they're not. I mean, all of us, 60% of us or more, have at least one ACE. So it's really all of us who are suffering, and we cannot ignore the problem. I think in a certain way, it makes people feel more like we have something in common. We've all got an ACE. And, you know, that's not a bad thing.
Yeah,
I like that.
No, it's true. I was looking at that list and my parents divorced. You know, everybody has something. Hopefully not as many of us have been hit or neglected, but it's a reality for so many people. And I think part of the reality in the state of New Mexico is that there has been so much cultural trauma, cultural loss, especially on the part of Native and Hispanic people. And there has also, I think, been a kind of pushback against the sort of white colonialist telling people what to do. So educational reformers come in who don't know a society, don't know a culture, don't know a group, and say, you should do this. It doesn't necessarily go over very well.
Exactly. And I'm really glad you brought that up, because tribal communities that I spoke to, and I cannot speak for them, I don't really, I would never want to do that, but what they most often said to me is that they feel that people don't want to hear about the historical trauma anymore. What they get is, oh, get over it. You know, it happened a long time ago. Or they do get interventions from people who don't live in the community, and they do say, here's a program. Why don't you get better? And it just doesn't work that way. It has to be homegrown.
Something that I'd like to ask all of you is, how are you seeing people who are thinking about this holistically? Because, I mean, you stop anybody on the street corner and they have their ideas about educational reform or how things could be done better. And a lot of politicians will try one thing or there will be a program, and it's kind of a piecemeal approach. Are you seeing people taking a kind of more multi-factor approach to really solving some of these problems of early childhood well-being in New Mexico?
That's interesting you say that, because it's one of the first stories we're going to be tackling in our next rollout, that need for collaboration and an end to the infighting, which is, as I keep hearing, so prevalent in the state.
That's what I have heard as well, and it's not a very sexy story. You know, someone sits and says, we need to change the system, and it makes the eyes glaze over a bit, but that's what people are saying, is that it's very splintered. People are not communicating. There's not enough data sharing. There's too much competition. There are all these old, almost like feuds between people that prevent us from moving forward.
And we'll be looking at other states to see how they address that same problem, because obviously we're not the only ones.
And it's a real complicated set of woes. One of the things that we looked at yesterday in the stories that came out was the legislative history over the last two administrations that looked at that have both bills and resolutions and memorials that try to address the problems that children have. And is one of our problems tied to the fact that our legislature only meets 30 days one session and 60 days the next session? They're all citizen legislators, and therefore it sort of narrows the pool from which we can draw lawmakers. And so that's an issue. There also are really positive things about New Mexico and growing up here, and one is that strong sense of family, for better or worse. And so we don't want to look at only, you know, the downside of it. And how do you take those strengths and maximize them? Mm-hmm. And we'll be looking at that too. And again, none of us are child well-being experts, but we know where to find them.
Well, and then there's this question of, again, of a political cycle for a state legislator might be 2 years or 4 years for the House and the Senate, or 4 years for governor, and maybe they've got 8 years if they get reelected. And these are terms where you can get something done or you can start to get the ball rolling. But if you're looking at your own reelection, you know, what's in it for you to think 20, 30, 40, you know, two generations down the line?
That's right. And the increasing role of money in politics and the need for candidates to always be seeking re-election. And a lot of advocates for children are well-meaning, but they don't necessarily have fat checkbooks. And so that's another reason that maybe those issues get overlooked.
And another reason that campaign finance reform is part of every single other problem that we're looking at in this world. What are your hopes for this year's series of reporting on early childhood well-being?
I think we really want to start a conversation, as Susan began by saying. That's our strongest goal. But we also want to have an impact in what that conversation is going to, you know, to include. So we're trying to, you know, strategize about the stories that we're presenting. What are the most, important stories that need exploration? What are things that haven't been written about? You know, what are the hidden stories that are out there that we didn't even know existed? That's what we're really planning on looking. And I think as now we're looking into the second rollout, we're starting to hear from readers. And things are starting to percolate in a way that we didn't recognize. And I'm working on the next, rollout and the next outline of stories. And I'm just seeing, wow, we have to change everything. We're just, we were headed on one road and we're now just widening that road, or we're just deviating completely. There are stories that we had no idea were there.
Because you're getting feedback from listeners?
Yes.
And from readers?
Oh, yeah. And, our reporters are going out and they're talking to people, and the kinds of people they're talking to have just kind of grown and become, richer. And it's a very exciting process.
And Mary Charlotte, it's not a coincidence that we're looking at the well-being of children in 2018, because 2018 is an election year, and New Mexicans will be, whether it's a Democrat or Republican, electing a new governor. And we want to raise this issue that candidates will address what their plans are in regard to children. And so we don't, again, have the solution, and we're very nonpartisan, but we want the community and for voters to start pressing the candidates on certain issues and what their position is in regard to changing the well-being of children in New Mexico.
Yes. We want people to kind of sit up and say, this is the most important issue of our time, and we need to address it. And I think if we just do that and nothing else, we'll have really accomplished what we set out to do.
I'd like to say that I have not talked to anyone who has not thought that this is a critical issue, and it's really important to New Mexicans. And people have been thinking of solutions. People have been wanting to propose solutions and get money for solutions. And I think there really is a lot of hope out there, and I think that New Mexico really can do something. I know there's always an argument that we're poor and we don't have enough money to do this or that. I've heard people say we have the money. It just is a matter of shifting resources and shifting priorities, and I think the state can do it.
And I think also getting buy-in from people who really want to make that shift. I mean, from just citizens, teachers, parents, and so on.
Yeah, it has to be, voters have to really make this an issue. Parents have to make this an issue at their schools. And it should build from the bottom up. I think patients even can come in. You can do an ACEs test online or other tests that look at your adverse childhood experiences. You can bring it to your doctor and say, look, this is what I've been through. Please consider this in my health care. So there are things that all of us can do.
If people want to get in touch with you guys, maybe somebody who's listening has a story that they want to tell, how can they do so?
I think the first place to go is our website, which is searchlightnm.com.
searchlightnm.com. Susan Bowe is Executive Director of Searchlight New Mexico. Sarah Salovich is Executive Editor, and Amy Lynn, Reporter. Watch for their stories, not only in the Santa Fe New Mexican, but in newspapers all over the state. And there's also going to be other media. Is that correct?
We're starting to reach out to radio stations and also some television stations, and we hope that we can saturate the market.
Excellent. Well, and you will be back on the Radio Cafe at another time, I hope soon. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.